Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Arun Kundanani, author of What is Anti-Racism?, who examines how the weaponizing of anti-Semitism has fueled dishonest attacks and repression of university students protesting Israel's vicious war in Gaza. Alice Hu of New York Communities for Change, who talks about the recent civil disobedience protests at Citibank's New York City headquarters, which kicked off summer of heat climate actions targeting Wall Street fossil fuel financiers. And Kim Ives, an editor with the Haiti Liberté newspaper, who assesses the credibility of Haiti's new transitional presidential council and the prospect of another foreign intervention in Haiti's affairs, the third in the last 30 years. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
South Africa's ruling African National Congress Party is facing its most difficult election since the end of apartheid. The ANC, marred by corruption and mass unemployment, may be forced to negotiate a coalition government if the party fails to win a majority in the May 29th election. The ANC's election trouble began with the reemergence of former disgraced President Jacob Zuma, who served 3 months in prison for refusing to testify in his corruption trial. Zuma, the former intelligence chief of the ANC during the war against apartheid, served as South Africa's fourth president from 2009 until he was forced to resign in 2018. Last December, Zuma declared his support for a new political party, Umkhonto we Sizwe, the ANC's now disbanded military wing. In recent polls, the party enjoys 13% support, largely because of Zuma's continued popularity in his native province. The ANC attempted to decertify Zuma's party and ban him from running for parliament, but lost both cases in South Africa's courts. In a statement late last year, Zuma blasted the ANC's current president, Cyril Ramaphosa, as a proxy for white capitalist interests. Amid ongoing gridlock on Capitol Hill, progress on passing the annual farm bill has all but stopped, with a September 30th expiration date looming and the November election just 6 months away. The major obstacle is disagreement between Republicans, who support expensive farm commodity payments and crop insurance expansions, and Democrats, who are fighting to preserve funding for critical nutrition assistance and farm conservation programs. Barnraiser Media reports that the fight centers on the Inflation Reduction Act, or IRA's, allocation of an additional $19.5 billion for conservation programs over a five-year period. Most of this funding is designated to support programs that mitigate the effects of climate change, such as using more cover crops, restoring wetlands, planting trees and shrubs, and expanding native plants and wildlife habitat. Republican leaders across the board have been attempting to raid the IRA conservation dollars in order to pay for more commodity subsidies. But recent polls have found that voters across six agriculture states oppose the GOP plan 3-1. Among Republican voters, that rate is a whopping 2-1. In advance of the November election, Democrats are being urged to forcefully point out that they are defenders of conservation programs while Republicans want to defund them. Native Americans frequently find themselves in the U.S. federal court to face a broad range of criminal charges, not just serious crimes such as murder, but lesser offenses like burglary. Once in federal court, Native Americans face sentencing guidelines far harsher than in most state courts. Diversion, probation, and other mitigation programs are assigned less often in federal courts than in state courts, as is a jury that includes their Native citizen peers. According to In These Times magazine, Native Americans are now 38% more likely to be behind bars than the rest of the U.S. population. Federal Native detainees are more likely, on average, to be younger, more likely to be women, and have less of a criminal history than the typical federal prisoner. The Major Crimes Act of 1885 established federal jurisdiction over Native residents who commit crimes on reservations. Joseph Holly of the Tomoic tribe of Western Shoshone Indians says there's no definitive line about how Native people are going to be treated by the law. Tanya Reynolds, council member also of the Tomoic tribe, says this unpredictability destroys confidence in the justice system. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Despite the arrests of more than 1,000 students protesting Israel's vicious war in Gaza, occupations and demonstrations on college campuses across the U.S. have continued to grow. Students calling for a ceasefire in Israel's Gaza air and ground assault that has now killed more than 34,000 Palestinians are also demanding universities divest their holdings in companies supplying weapons to Israel. Many university administrators have responded to the overwhelmingly peaceful protests at dozens of campuses across the country, with attempts to suppress students' right of free speech, with suspensions and police raids resulting in mass arrests, and in some cases a show of armed force, such as occurred at Ohio State University and Indiana University, where police snipers with rifles were deployed on campus rooftops. While protesting anti-war students hold a wide range of views on Israel and include many Jewish students active in groups such as Jewish Voice for Peace, anti-Semitic signs and chants are rare and usually not associated with students. But many politicians and pro-Israel activists have broadly denounced the students in their message as both anti-Semitic and pro-Hamas. While this is clearly false, that charge has been used by college administrators and state governments to brutally crack down on students for merely expressing normal human empathy with Palestinians in Gaza. Your reporter spoke with Arun Kundanani, author of the book The End of Tolerance, who examines how the weaponizing of anti-Semitism has fueled dishonest attacks and repression of students protesting Israel's war in Gaza.
What's happened is that the presidents and the administrators of the universities were hauled before Congress and accused of being over-tolerant of anti-Semitism with no evidence. And the evidence was that students were chanting "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," which is not an anti-Semitic slogan, but a slogan that says wherever Palestinians live, whether they live in the occupied territories or whether they live in Israel itself, they have the right to freedom. If you disagree with that slogan, then you're saying you disagree that Palestinians have the right to freedom just like anyone else. So it's not an anti-Semitic slogan, but that has been presented as an anti-Semitic slogan. Wearing a kafir, the Palestinian scarf, has been presented as some kind of statement of anti-Semitic hatred. These are all lies, but these were presented in Congress as if these were factual claims. And university administrators and presidents accepted that as the terms of debate and said that they would repress these students who were taking this stand. The Democrats, unfortunately, went along with this. It was essentially a Republican strategy to discredit the movement in universities for racial equality, essentially, which they've long opposed. The Democrats went along with it. And as a result, now you have a situation where wherever these encampments have been set up, in many cases, universities have called in the police to pretty much beat up students and faculty members who are engaged in peaceful protests. These students aren't even disrupting universities. They're not even disrupting the normal day-to-day business of universities, which is what you would expect to see in a civil disobedience kind of campaign that we have a long history of in the United States. They're not even doing that. They're simply registering their presence and registering their voice by taking up a little bit of space in these courtyards. By any definition, this is peaceful protest. There have been attempts to smear these protests as anti-Semitic, but the examples that are given always incredibly minor or non-existent or not having credibility. There have been attempts to provoke these students into anti-Semitism that haven't worked. And so they've sent in the cops, and we've seen violence. And what's remarkable is that in the face of this attempt at violence, oppression, more and more students have joined these encampments, and more universities are doing it around the country, around the world even. So I think we need to salute the bravery of these students. We need to give them our support. They are expressing, as you say, a very basic, decent human sentiment that when there is suffering in the world, we are all implicated. We all have an obligation to do something about it. And that obligation is more intense if our own government, as in the case of the United States, is sending billions of dollars every year to support this mass violence, this attempts to eliminate a population of Palestinians that Israel is carrying out. And I think that the universities, I think, have underestimated the power of what they're up against. They're hoping, I think, that this thing will fizzle out, but it's not going to. The students are leading a change in public opinion across the whole of U.S. society on this question.
Thank you, Arun. One other frightening aspect of what's going on right now is you've got right-wing Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley and Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton calling for President Biden to deploy the National Guard on college campuses to, quote-unquote, protect Jewish students. We've seen brutal tactics being used by the state police in some cases on university campuses when they're called in to clear out these encampments. You've also got snipers on the roof of Ohio State University in the same state where the Kent State Massacre occurred on May 4th, 1970, where four students were killed in anti-Vietnam War protests. It seems like there is a design to provoke violence here on these mostly, and I would say 99%, peaceful protests that are occurring on dozens of campuses all around the country.
Yeah, and these developments are very scary because, you know, even if it's just political posturing and even if the real desire in the beginning of this process is not to actually have shots fired on campuses, once you deploy armed men, whether it's the National Guard or the NYPD or whoever, onto campus situations, and when you've sent the message that, well, these students are basically Hamas supporters, they're terrifying, they're hateful, once you set that all up, it's not hard to see how you create the danger that someone will get very seriously hurt, if not killed, if the police escalate it. The students are very committed to maintaining a kind of peaceful protest. The extremism of the repressive measures tells us that they've lost the argument. You don't need to use this level of violence against a political opponent if you have a compelling argument that is winning. But they're losing the argument. They're losing public opinion. So all that they have on their side is the power of donors to impose policies on institutions like universities and the power of violence to suppress, to repress, to censor. And that's what we're seeing at the moment. And even with those efforts in place, they're still losing.
That was Arun Kundanani, author of What is Anti-Racism and the End of Tolerance. Find more analysis and commentary on the U.S. student protest movement against Israel's war in Gaza by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. On April 24th and 25th, 52 climate activists were arrested for blocking the doors to Citibank's global headquarters in New York City, where 12,000 employees work. The action, called Spring Spark, was a dry run for what organizers are calling the Summer of Heat, which will target banks and other institutions in New York City that enable the operation of fossil fuel companies whose projects are exacerbating the climate crisis. The protests are being organized by local groups involving people of color, working families and youth, as well as a national coalition comprised of hundreds of member groups called Stop the Money Pipeline. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who participated in the action, spoke with Alice Hu, senior climate campaigner with New York Communities for Change, one of the member organizations of the coalition, whose group had worked on bread-and-butter issues important to working families, like housing, immigration, and labor rights. But after the destruction of Hurricane Sandy, they've made the climate fight a priority issue. Here she talks about the protest's focus on Citibank and what's ahead in the planned summer of heat climate actions.
We put together two back-to-back shutdowns of the Citibank headquarters, where we shut down every single entrance using nonviolent civil disobedience in order to call out the bank, because Citibank is the world's second largest funder of fossil fuels. It's poured over $333 billion into fossil fuels since the Paris agreements were signed in 2016, and it shows no signs of stopping. We actually have, as you mentioned, a campaign that we're launching called the Summer of Heat, where we actually want to sustain this level of nonviolent civil disobedience, mass nonviolent civil disobedience, for an entire summer, 12 plus weeks, day after day doing this stuff. And as you can imagine, this is a huge team effort. This is a huge movement effort. As with any other industry and business in the world, right, at the heart of it is the money. And when you have big banks pouring billions of dollars every single year into fossil fuels, when you have large investors pouring billions or even trillions of dollars into fossil fuels every year, and when you have insurance companies insuring pipelines, insuring methane gas build out, insuring fossil fuel production and expansion, and doing so in a way that essentially is spelling out mass death, right? Because we know the impacts of fossil fuels. We know what they're causing on our communities. When you look at all of that, you realize that the fossil fuel industry couldn't exist without Wall Street.
The focus last week was on one bank, Citibank, which is, as you said, the second largest investor in fossil fuels. In the summer, you're actually hoping to do actions every day or every week of the summer? Or how? What do you have in mind exactly? And you're not just going to be targeting Citibank, is that correct?
Yeah, we hope to be doing at least 3 to 5 mass civil disobedience protests every single week during the summer. We aren't just targeting Citibank. We think that ultimately Wall Street as a whole has the answer, and it's not just Citibank or just banks in general. Of course, like I mentioned, there's also big investors such as asset managers and private equity firms. We're also looking at insurance companies. Without the insurance that these companies provide, actually fossil fuel projects couldn't be built. So it's actually a super viable and important arm as well to hit. But, you know, we do have a focus on Citibank. The reasons are several. One, just because we think that ultimately we're trying to get a company to be the first mover in the banking sector. We think that Citibank could be that company. You know, they try to greenwash themselves, I should say, as a climate leader. Of course, they're not. You know, the numbers don't lie. You know, actions speak louder than words. And when you're pouring so much money into fossil fuels, the cause of climate change, you're not a climate leader. But, you know, they want to position themselves as such. And, you know, the CEO, Jane Fraser, she makes statements saying that, you know, they care about sustainability, so on and so forth. And so our internal analysis is that they could be poised to be the first mover of U.S. banks and actually take a real big step in terms of ending fossil fuel financing. You know, Citibank is not just responsible for climate change. Citibank was one of the chief architects of the 2008 financial meltdown, right? Received a massive government bailout. I should mention that Citibank is the world's largest foreign financial institution in Israel.
Everybody who was blocking was removed pretty early on, I would say. It wasn't very late in the workday. So this is, I guess you would say, a symbolic campaign, or at least those days were symbolic rather than really keeping them from doing their work. Would you agree with that?
I would say that this does still represent a step up. Our goal was to actually prevent workers from entering the building to create a real disruption internally. We know that afterwards we got our hands on a headquarter-wide email that the Citibank PR team had to send out to every single employee that worked out of that building. They had to explain what the protest was about. They had to, you know, explain to their workers, you know, in the future when they come, don't agitate, don't whatever. And so we do think that they have been forced to actually respond to us because we caused an amount of disruption that was non-trivial, right? Because if it was just truly like symbolic, just, you know, let's say only the front doors are blocked and everybody just went in through a side door, perhaps the company wouldn't have felt that they needed to actually respond. We've done many years of petitioning. We've had climate and community leaders have pleading talks, right, with the bank leadership and with the bank's chief sustainability officer and so on. And none of it has budged them. So what we now want and need to do is to actually make them pay attention to us. Now, I do think that sustained mass civil disobedience is such a powerful tool, and we really need to be scaling that up in the climate movement in the months and years to come. And if we have any chance of really ending fossil fuels and really winning a safe and, you know, healthy future for all of us.
That was Alice Hu, senior climate campaigner with New York Communities for Change. Learn more about the planned Summer of Heat climate protests by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Amid ongoing violence in the streets of the Haitian capital of Port-au-Prince, where armed gangs control much of the city, Haiti's newly installed transitional presidential council convened on April 30th and chose former sports minister Fritz Balizaire as the country's prime minister and Edgar LeBlanc Fils, former president of the Haitian Senate, as president of the body. Haiti's unpopular acting prime minister, Ariel Henry, had resigned on April 24th. After a coalition of armed groups had earlier blocked his return to Haiti. The seven-member council's mission is to oversee day-to-day governance of Haiti, schedule elections within a year, and prepare for the arrival of a Kenyan police force to quell the violence. Representatives of the United States, Canada, and members of the Caribbean Community Regional Bloc known as CARICOM had met last month in Jamaica on March 11th and established the framework for Haiti's Presidential Transitional Council. Amid growing food shortages, more than 90,000 people have fled Port-au-Prince over the past month. Some 360,000 Haitians have been left homeless in recent years, as battles between rival gangs have destroyed entire neighborhoods. Your reporter spoke with Kim Ives, a journalist and editor with the weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté. Here he assesses the credibility of Haiti's new transitional presidential council and the prospect of another foreign intervention in Haiti's affairs, the third in the last 30 years.
Two groups which have been warring for the past 4 years have come together into a united front called the Vivre Ensemble, the Live Together. And this is really the work of Jimmy Cherizier, a former cop who basically has been moving to the left, moving to a revolutionary position over the past 6-7 years, I'll say. And he managed to cobble together this alliance, which is, of course, very ragtag, very motley, very contradictory. But that was really what brought about the crisis, which really erupted on February 29th. Essentially, the Vivre Ensemble occupied the airport in Port-au-Prince and said, Ariel Henry, you're not landing here. You're not coming back. And that was the beginning of the crisis. That forced Washington to scramble a meeting on March 11th in Kingston, Jamaica. And now with Ariel, who they held on to for too long, they went to the other extreme and they said, okay, we're going to put the entire political class into this 9-member commission they've concocted, which is basically everybody from the left to the right in it. And it's completely dysfunctional. It's a total joke because it can't really work. They're all infighting, fighting among each other, fighting even the groups who have seats are fighting among themselves. And at the same time, the whole condition for them to sit on this council was they had to accept another foreign military intervention into Haiti. This will be the third in 30 years, 1994, 2004, and now again, 2024. So the Haitian people are fed up with military occupations. All these people are seen as traitors, including the Fami Lavalas representative. And that is why you have this incipient, what we call an incipient revolution underway.
Thank you for that, Kim. Explain to our audience, what is the ostensible mission of this transitional presidential council? What are they supposed to be doing in terms of future elections or bringing order to how our media describes the violence and chaos in the streets there in Port-au-Prince particularly?
Well, their official name is the Transitional Commission to Bring a Peaceful and Orderly Transition, you know, which is just the most absurd, ridiculous thing. I mean, it's so far past that point. It's really ludicrous, I could say. And their mission is to pick a president and a prime minister to oversee this transition.
There have been reports that U.S. troops and or mercenaries will be taking charge of guarding this new presidential transition council in Haiti. What can you tell us about that? That certainly could be a very dangerous flashpoint in the future.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, that's, I could say, almost exclusively Haiti Liberté who came with that story this past week. One of our better investigative reporters, Travis Ross, found this in one of the deep state think tanks. The U.S. end game is they want to get in place a thing called the Global Fragility Act, which is to put U.S. troops on the ground based in Haiti and put the country on an intravenous lifeline of USAID food. But they can't do it by bringing in the 82nd Airborne and doing it and then having them elect a government that invites in the U.S. It would sort of defeat the purpose. They don't want to be as blatant and transparent as they were in 1915. That's how they did it then. So they want to use a proxy force, which is these Kenyans, Benin, Chad, El Salvador, a few other countries, Barbados, the Bahamas, put a blackface proxy force in place to buckle it down, but they can't even get there because this presidential council is so fragile that they need to protect that so the presidential council can renew Ariel Henry's invitation to the Kenyans to come in. So in that little tiny gap, they're trying to figure, what do we do? Do we bring in U.S. troops? That's what former U.S. Ambassador to Haiti James Foley proposed in an op-ed in the Washington Post last month. But another deep state a guy called Keith Mines, and that's what we talked about. He proposes mercenaries, or what he calls privatized security forces. And in fact, there was a thing today where the U.S. is giving $1 million to some company to start to bring in security people. So we'll see which way it goes, but it looks like the U.S., as hard as they try, as their empire crumbles, is having trouble even handling the situation in Haiti.
That was Kim Ives, a journalist and editor with a weekly newspaper, Haiti Liberté. Learn more about the ongoing crisis in Haiti by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WEFR in Fairmount, West Virginia, WHYR in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KKRN in Round Mountain, California, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.